Nora. Spiritual leader Rabbi Sam Karf ponders the pulse of kindness in this short narrative.
Some months ago, I was visiting New York City. It was early in the morning, and I needed to stretch my legs, so I decided to walk around the block a few times. As I was rounding the corner closest to our hotel, I saw a man sitting in a wheelchair at the corner. He wasn't selling anything. He wasn't asking for anything. He was drinking coffee and eating a donut that had been brought to him. He was poorly dressed. I didn't know anything about him, but the face fascinated me. The face just radiated goodness, as did his smile, as I rounded the corner. The second time I encountered him in my rounding, he called out, "Number two." The third time, "Number three." And the fourth, which turned out to be the last time, "Number four." But for some reason, I couldn't go past him. I approached him. I took my gloves off. I lowered myself so that I would be even with his wheelchair. I extended my hand and said, "I'm Sam." And he responded, "Hi, I'm Jim." And I said, "Jim, I have the sense that you are a very special person." And at that point, he teared up, said, "Thanks, I needed that." That's all that we said, except, "God bless you, Jim." And he said, "God bless you, Sam."
It's the simplicity that just knocks me out. It really is. Jake, you know Rabbi Karf, right?
Yes, sir, I
do. What do you think of that story?
Knowing Rabbi Karf, it's an incredible story. He's a very, very good judge of character.
He really is. And I think that's very well said. When he was on the show many years ago, not many years ago, but 3 or 4 years ago, he talked about messianic moments. And I love when he talks about this. And this story was not one of the messianic moments. This was about kindness and about good deed doing. But one of the most wonderful stories that he tells, a simple story about a messianic moment, because I asked him, what does it mean to have a messianic moment? And he says a messianic moment is one of those dynamic, evolving episodes that occur when people, in fact, ignite each other. They create a kind of coalition of kindness and of love. And to describe, he explained how he was in the emergency room one night, and he observed people of all races, all creeds, all religions, all socioeconomic groups. They were sitting there. It was in Methodist, I believe. And he said that, as you might imagine, people were worried about their loved ones who they had brought into the emergency room. And he said that as he watched them, they looked at each other, each of them, and there started to become sort of a innate connectivity. So, for example, someone would get up and go to the vending machine and turn to a stranger and say, "Listen, I hope your husband's okay. I'm getting some coffee. Would you like some coffee?" And then somebody would turn to another person and ask, "You know, I know that you brought your daughter in here and you haven't heard about her for a long time. I hope everything is okay." And suddenly you find that all of these strangers, because they're sitting in an emergency room, are talking with each other. And they're clearly there because they love the ones who are in danger. They're ill, they're injured, they're hurt, and they're in emergencies. And yet they turn to each other, rendering support, rendering encouragement. And as Rabbi Karf talks about this, he said that after about 90 minutes, everyone was speaking to each other. Everyone was rendering support. Everybody was doing something that really smacked of unselfishness. And that sense of unselfishness, the idea of turning to each other and asking about your own loved one, your husband, your son, your daughter, is really a messianic moment. And those are moments that, frankly, are very few and extraordinarily far between. We need to see those. We need to identify those. We need to promote those. And I remember him talking about that, and it really made an indelible impression on me, because these messianic moments and these moments of kindness, where you walk around a block and you look at a stranger and you simply say, something tells me you're very special. And the person responds, and I think you're very special. God bless you, and God bless you. These are simple words. They're done with direct eye contact. They're done with a level of empathy and the kind of cadence that renders sincerity and poignancy. And it simply works. It just works. It just plain works. You know, a real quick change in tone. Got to ask people what their favorite Christmas or holiday movies are. I was watching one of my favorites on the way here. Not on the way here, but as I was getting ready to do the show tonight, I was watching It's a Wonderful Life. And It's a Wonderful Life is a wonderful movie. It's always been my favorite movie. Mary, Mary, because there's something about Jimmy Stewart that brings out the innocence in all of us. It's a meaningful film. There are others that come to mind, but Jacob, I'm almost afraid to ask you. Well, actually, not almost. I am afraid to ask you. But what is your favorite holiday movie, Christmas movie?
I have a tie for top place. That's National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Uh-huh.
Gotta love the Griswolds.
Well, you I guess you do have to love them. That's what you say. It's a leading statement. You gotta love the Griswolds. And actually, it's very funny. It is very funny.
Yes, yes. And then the other one is Bill Murray's Scrooged.
Ah, okay. That's kind of a surprise. Well, what do you like about that one?
I like how it's of a more modern corporate version of the Christmas Carol.
Okay.
Right. It modernizes it into actual corporations.
Right. So that practicality gives it a little more of an applied topspin.
Yes.
Right. Shay, what about you? Have you got one?
He stole it.
He stole it?
He stole it.
Well, I mean, you can have the same favorite movie.
It's a...
I think that's adorable that you two, a married couple, share the same favorite movie.
It's tradition in my family.
And which one is it? Which one is it?
Christmas Vacation.
Christmas Vacation. What's your favorite line? Do you have a favorite line?
I can't say that I do, no.
No?
Not particularly.
I mean, what about the squirrel popping out of the tree? That one kind of is funny. That one is a little funny. I know that has a little depth and profoundness to it, but, you know, that squirrel coming out of the tree is always a good one. Now, you just saw The Wizard of Oz recently, didn't you? Right?
Yes.
Don't be embarrassed. You saw The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Did you like it?
I did.
Yeah. You know, I have a lot of students who's never seen The Wizard of Oz, and that's the truth.
Oh,
and I ask them if they have running water at home, because I kind of wonder where they've been. But I think it's wonderful that you've seen it. Pretty good, huh?
It is.
Yeah.
After you get past the first, you know, maybe 15 minutes.
Oh, the black and white part.
Can you do any imitations of any of the characters?
No.
Like the Scarecrow. Can't do the Scarecrow, right? He took some of my arm and threw it over there, and then he took my legs and threw it over here. Right? No?
No.
Put him up.
Definitely.
Put him up. I'll fight you with a one hand on my back. Dorothy, Dorothy. You and your little dog Toto, too. Right?
No.
Will! Oh, no, I'm a very good man. I'm just a very bad wizard. Pay no attention behind that man behind that curtain. Right? Yeah, everybody's tuning out right now. I better shut up. All right, very good. Very, very good. Now, Kris Kringle's lawyer in Miracle on 34th Street, speaking of films, makes a very powerful claim worth revisiting when he says that faith is believing in things when common sense tells us not to. Now, I say revisit because, like many good movies, we are prompted to resurrect things that matter. Common sense, for instance, where is it? We talked about this a little earlier, if you remember, and I'm a little concerned about this because don't you ever think is about common sense? Do people have it anymore? Right? You're too smart people.
Common I think about that all
does,
the time.
Yeah, all the time. It's hard not to, right? Well, apparently some people think it's dead. There is an obituary that was written in the London Times a year and a half ago, and I wanted to share it with you because I think that this says an awful lot. Again, this is an obituary printed in the London Times in 2011. Today, we mourn the passing of a beloved old friend, Common Sense, who has been with us for many years. No one knows for sure how old he was, since his birth records were long ago lost in bureaucratic red tape. He will be remembered as having cultivated such valuable lessons as knowing when to come in from out of the cold, why the early bird gets the worm, life isn't always fair, and maybe it was my fault. Common Sense lived by simple, sound financial policies. Don't spend more than you can earn, and reliable strategies like adults, not children, are in charge. His health began to deteriorate rapidly when well-intentioned but overbearing regulations were set in place. Reports of a 6-year-old boy charged with sexual harassment for kissing a classmate, teens suspended from school for using mouthwash after lunch, and a teacher fired for reprimanding an unruly student only worsened his condition. Common sense lost ground when parents attacked teachers for doing the job that they themselves had failed to do in disciplining their unruly children. It declined even further when schools were required to get parental consent to administer sun lotion or an aspirin to a student, but could not inform parents when a student became pregnant and wanted to have an abortion. Common sense lost the will to live as the churches became businesses, and criminals received better treatment than their victims. Common sense took a beating when you couldn't defend yourself from a burglar in your own home, and the burglar could sue you for assault. Common sense finally gave up the will to live after a woman failed to realize that a steaming cup of coffee was hot. She spilled a little in her lap and was promptly awarded a huge settlement. Common sense was preceded in death by his parents, truth and trust, by his wife, discretion, by his daughter, responsibility, and by his son, reason. He is survived by his 4 stepbrothers. I know my rights. I want it now. Someone else is to blame, and I'm a victim. Not many attended his funeral because so few realized he was gone. If you still remember him, pass this on. If not, well, join the majority and do absolutely nothing. I thought that really said it all, because this is a time of year where we love and we're kind and we give gifts and we count our blessings. But it also has to be a time of year when we start thinking about just that, how we think and how we act and how we guide people toward very productive destinations, how we guide them into discovering who they are, and in us trying to facilitate this thing that we call truth. Because after all, that is also a part of the holidays. So we had a lot of fun talking about movies, talking about anything from Chevy Chase to others. But, you know, that one line in Miracle on 34th Street, faith is believing in things when common sense tells you not to, struck me as gold. Because we have to have faith. But we have to have faith because we rely on common sense. And if we don't have common sense, I'm not entirely sure that we can really have faith. Just something to be thinking about. You know, New Year's Eve with Greg next Thursday, and then Warren Holloman, Rabbi Laura Sheinkoff, back to me as we roll with rituals and styles that give birth to great shows every week, every month, every year. I'd like to tell you my favorite New Year's Eve story in just a moment, because although, like most in this genre, the message is far more universal. It tends to fuse life and death and speaks to children the way that they should be spoken to, with love and understanding. And the story that I'm talking about is Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Match Girl. It was so terribly cold. Snow was falling, and it was almost dark. It was the last evening of the year. In the cold and gloom, a poor little girl, bareheaded and barefoot, was walking through the streets. Of course, when she had left her house, she had slippers on. But what good had they been? They were very big slippers, way too big for her, for they belonged to her mother. See, the little girl had lost them running across the road when 2 carriages had rattled by them terribly fast. And so the little girl walked on her naked feet, which were quite red and blue with the cold. In an old apron, she carried several packages of matches, and she held a box of them in her hand. No one had bought any from her all day long, and no one had given her 1 red cent. Shivering with cold and hunger, she crept along, a picture of misery, poor little girl. The snowflakes fell on her long, fair hair, which hung in pretty curls over her neck. In all the windows, lights were shining, and there was a wonderful smell of roast goose, for it was New Year's Eve. Yes, she thought of that. In a corner formed by two houses, one of which projected farther out into the street than the other, she sat down and drew up her little feet under her. She was getting colder and colder, but did not dare to go home, for she had sold no matches, nor earned a single cent, and her father would surely beat her. Besides, it was cold at home, for they had nothing over them but a roof which the wind whistled through. Even because of the biggest cracks had been stuffed with straw, it didn't do any good. Her hands were almost dead with cold. Oh, how much one little match might warm her! If she could only take one from the box and rub it against the wall and warm her hands. So she drew one match out. Bratch! How it sputtered and burned and made a warm, bright flame like a little candle. As she held her hands over it, it gave a strange light. It really seemed to the little girl as if she were sitting before a great iron stove with shining brass knobs and a brass cover. That was the image she saw. How wonderfully the fire burned, she thought. How comfortable it was. The youngster stretched out her feet to warm them, too. Then the little flame went out, the stove vanished, and she had only the remains of a burnt match in her hand. She struck another match against the wall. It burned brightly, and when the light fell upon the wall, it became transparent like a thin veil, and she could see through it into the room. On the table, a snow-white cloth was spread, and on it stood a shining dinner service. The roast goose steamed gloriously, stuffed with apples and prunes, and what was still better, the goose jumped down from the dish and waddled along the floor with a knife and fork in its breast, right over to the little girl. And then the match went out, and she could see only the thick, cold wall. She lighted another match, and then she was sitting under the most beautiful Christmas tree. It was much larger and much more beautiful than the one she had seen last Christmas through the glass door at the rich merchant's home. Thousands of candles burned on the green branches, and colored pictures like those in the print shops looked down at her. The little girl reached both her hands toward them. Then the match went out, but the Christmas lights mounted higher. She saw them now as bright stars in the sky. One of them fell down, forming a long line of fire. Now someone is dying, thought the little girl, for her old grandmother, the only person who had loved her and who was now dead, had told her that when a star fell down, a soul went up to God. She rubbed another match against the wall. It became bright again, and in the glow the old grandmother stood clear and shining, kind and lovely. "Grandmother," cried the child, "oh, take me with you. I know you will disappear when the match is burned out. You'll vanish like the warm stove, the wonderful roast goose, and the beautiful big Christmas tree." And she quickly struck the whole bundle of matches, for she wished to keep her grandmother with her. And the matches burned with such a glow that it became brighter than daylight. Grandmother had never been so grand and beautiful. She took the little girl in her arms, and both of them flew in brightness and joy above the earth, very, very high. And up there was neither cold, nor hunger, nor fear. They were with God. But in the corner, leaning against the wall, sat the little girl with red cheeks and a smiling mouth, frozen to death on the last evening of the old year. The New Year's sun rose upon a little pathetic figure. The child sat there stiff and cold, holding the matches, of which one bundle was almost burned. She wanted to warm herself, the people said. No one imagined what beautiful things she had seen. and how happily she had gone with her old grandmother into the bright new year. It's a story that always touches me, and if it doesn't touch you, you better check your pulse, because that one really does work. And, you know, on this show, we sometimes merge personal narratives with fairy tales and fables, folk tales. And this is an example of a made-up story that is so incredibly true. Anybody out there who loves their grandparents, I do. I know that so many stories have been about grandparents, because grandparents are somehow souls to our levels of discovery. Somehow they give us the best sense of who we are. Maybe it's because they can distance themselves. Maybe it's because it's the separate generation. But I always tell the story about my own grandfather, who was my hero. He was in Dachau concentration camp for 3.5 years. And as you might imagine, he saw the worst possible atrocities known to humankind. And I was raised by my grandparents. We all lived in the same house, 3 generations of people. And every year around this time, he told me the story about this gold watch that I never even thought he had. Now, he started to tell me the story when I was about 5 years old. So as you might imagine, he told me a long time. And this story lasted just a few minutes, but he told me this story year in and year out. And when you're about 5 years old, you listen to your grandfather because you love him. And then when you listen to it, when you're 10, 12, 13, 14, you're getting a little bored. But you realize that this is a man of very few words, and therefore every word had to mean something. Well, the story was is that he had a gold watch, and he kept it in his sock while he was in Dachau concentration camp. His sock, because he was able to keep his clothing. He was a laborer, and as a laborer, he was able to stay fully attired, and he had to hide the watch because obviously he didn't want the Nazis to see it and take it away. He also told me that it was a symbol of hope that one day he would run across my mother and my grandmother again. My mom and my grandmother were separated from my grandfather. They were in Stutthof concentration camp. So my grandfather tells me the story, and he tells me that again the watch was a symbol of hope that he would one day run across my mother and my grandmother. And they did. Now, when my grandfather died in 1979, it was a very cold day in April, I remember. A very good friend of the family came up to me with a small box, cotton-laced. And in that box was the gold watch to which he referred all those years. And under the watch, small piece of scratch paper that read, "I love you," which was typical him, because he was a man of very few words, but every word meant something. Every word meant something. I think about that story about my grandfather, and that's a true story. And we hear the story about the little match girl who talks about her grandmother and how her grandmother was the only one that really loved her. A poor child whose grandmother loved her. And she froze to death, and she went with her grandmother. And that sounds so terribly sad. But you know, this is the time of the year where sometimes sad things rock, and sometimes they roll, and sometimes they're very meaningful, and we have to be able to treat them. We're not hearing a lot of happy stories tonight, but that's not done intentionally. We're just talking about stories that seem to be seasonal. We're talking about stories that teach us a lesson, that have some poignant consequence, that helps us become better people, that transforms us, that somehow takes us on these remarkable journeys and returns us safely to the present. We become better people by listening to these stories, and that's what the show is about. So What's Your Story is a story about you. It's a story about the community. It's a story about all of us having something to share. You see, this is not a show with a bunch of professional storytellers. This is a program with people who have stories to tell. And there's a big difference. Sometimes I make a big deal out of the fact that people are natural storytellers. People have a hard time understanding that, but we are. See, all of our lives are filled with episodes, moments that are frozen in time. And when we tell a story, what we do, in effect, is that we are telling a story that is ready to thaw. It's just being de-iced. That's all there is to it. Think about stories. Think about trigger mechanisms. Think about things that you feel will make you special. I have a couple of suggestions for you. Let me just read a couple, if I may. For example, one way to start thinking about stories, especially during this time of the year, is to list what you love. For example, I could blow an entire afternoon doing what? When I was a kid, I used to love fill in that blank. I've always wanted to become really good at what? If I could do one thing every day of my life, what would that be? If I could lose track of time, where would I go? Nothing clears my head like, when I'm feeling drained, all I want to do is, I feel most connected to my body when I'm doing what? In my daydreams, I imagine myself as, and I get a shot of energy when I do what? Map a typical day. Think about things that you love. Ask yourself the kinds of questions that you know will bring you into truthful discovery. Who would you love to have dinner with if you could choose anybody in history? What is it about you that makes you special? If you had to give yourself a first name that was an adjective, what would that be? Make sure you know what an adjective is, but nevertheless, once you do, if your first name was an adjective, what would it be? What are the kinds of stories that you think about when you think about yourself? What were some of your favorite children's stories? What do you have around the house that reminds you of stories? What are the kinds of thought processes that sink into your mind when you think about what makes you unique? You know, every one of us is unique, and every one of us has something to offer. And stories teach us that. Stories allow us to remember what it means to offer something to someone, ourselves. And the most beautiful thing about a story really is that when we're telling one, well, other people have to listen to us, you know? And when we tell a story, we have to share things about ourselves and give ourselves permission to do so. But when we're listening to a story, we become unselfish. Suddenly, another person matters. And when another person matters, well, it just doesn't get any better than that, does it? Because another person mattering, well, isn't that what the holidays are about? That's what they're all about. Well, Scooter is going to be back next week with The Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. I want you to make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or just chilling out, please join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And I think that that's just about the best thing we can do. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. On behalf of our rotating hosts, Greg, Warren, Laura, Jake, Jay, thank you for showing up tonight. I appreciate it. And myself, have a warm and story-filled Christmas and a new year that brings you more happiness than the law allows. Be good to each other. I'm Dr. Hank reminding you that on any given day, it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. So to honor him, pa-ra-pa-pum-pum, when we come.
With just a few weeks remaining, your chance to go to New York for dinner and a show with Democracy Now! Is almost up. KPFT is raffling off a trip to NYC, including airfare, for just $20 per ticket or $100 for six. You'll be in the running to win a trip to the Big Apple for dinner with Amy Goodman and front row seats at the production of Democracy Now! Proceeds support KPFT and its great programming. You'll have a chance to win the most affordable vacation you've ever taken. Get tickets online at kpft.org or call 713-526-4000 during